and good morning. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to bring you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us on restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Good morning, Mark.
Hey, Francis, how you doing?
I'm well. We haven't had a show in a couple of weeks now.
This is our first big show since the big storm.
Yeah, yeah. My goodness, that was a storm, huh? Superstorm Sandy. We're in New Jersey. I don't know if you guys know that. It was, you know, we've been through a few extreme weather events. And
well, you know, if you're a regular listener of the show, you know that my house flooded last year. Late August with Irene. It did not flood this time, but lots of other people have experienced some craziness in their lives.
Yeah, it's nuts. Well, you know, it's funny. An interesting thing that I would like to sort of address is where we are here in New Brunswick. We're in a city, right? And I think if we had been out in the suburbs on a highway in the middle of nowhere or in the country, when extreme weather events like this are approaching, I'm pretty sure we would close. Our default would be to close.
Mm-hmm.
But being in the middle of a city, small city though it is, it's a walking city. And, you know, I was inspired by, you know, there was that one bar that has been open for like 80 years and has never closed, stayed open during Katrina in New Orleans. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so many people talked about what a lifeline that was, that even when the power went out and they were abandoned, that bar stayed open and they got down to serving saltines and what warm beer, but they were there.
Well, I gave a staff note to the staff.
Well, I was just saying that we sort of are inspired by that sensibility, yeah, and try and be here for the community as much as we can.
Yeah. On Wednesday, I was talking to the staff before service. We were cleaning up Wednesday, and then Thursday we reopened. And I was talking to our staff, and I said, listen, anybody who ever tells you that your job is not important or this vocation is not important has never worked a week like the week you're about to work.
Yeah.
Because you see it in people's eyes. This is their, you know, there are a bunch of people here who are coming out to dinner simply because they have no heat and they need respite. They need a place to eat. They need, you know, that kind of sustenance. And then there's a whole nother level of people who are here because this is a place they're comfortable. This is a place that makes them feel good. And they've spent a week not feeling good.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, we closed, to fill everybody, we closed the restaurant on Monday. We tried to stay open through the storm on Monday night because we are right across the street from a hotel that was booked. And now all the hotels in Jersey are booked with people who are displaced from their homes, you know.
Sure.
And we wound up, the police in New Brunswick closed the streets, even to pedestrians and local traffic, on late Monday afternoon or mid-Monday afternoon. And so we then said, okay, listen, we got to get people home
because
everybody
who worked on Monday night was somebody who lived within a few blocks of the restaurant.
Yeah, all walking distance, and we had a spare hotel room across the street. But, you know, I really wanted to stay open. It's good that we didn't stay open because we did lose power shortly thereafter, and we were gone for a couple of days. But, you know, this is when you really feel like you're part of a community, you know, this is when you really know that you are part of a community. And we have had some people come back now since we got our doors open on Thursday. We just sent out an email that said, hey, we're here and we're back. It's been really enheartening. It's moving, actually.
It is. And people need comforting at this time. A lot of people lost their houses. A lot of people don't know what they've lost yet. Still haven't been able to find out what they've lost. And they don't feel great. And they need a place to make them feel better.
Well, and they need a little bit of normalcy. And we are so fortunate because so many of our colleagues and friends and peers lost restaurants, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, a lot of the disruption to the hospitality industry is, you know, I was reading about the United States Bartenders Guild. Jason Luttrell sent an email out to who's the president of that organization, and also Leslie Townsend from the Manhattan Cocktail Classic, mm-hmm, who's the founder of that, sent out emails talking about, we haven't even been able to yet take stock of what bars are lost. And let's remember, look, it sounds like a trivial thing to talk about. Obviously, getting people food and water and shelter and their power back is, you know, of primary importance. But you know, some of the businesses that were lost are these, you know, iconic neighborhood cocktail joints. And a lot of these are small. You talk about your small businesses. A lot of these bars and restaurants are small businesses. So, I don't know. It's just it's been a moving and interesting week, and I'm looking forward to
it is
putting things back together.
There are weeks like this where you know you chose the right profession.
Yeah.
You know that, and believe me, there are plenty of weeks where you wonder whether you chose the right profession. But this is one of those weeks where you just know you're doing the right thing.
Yeah, I agree. Well, listen, we have a guest coming up on the line. Robert Simonson is the cocktail and spirits reporter for the New York Times, no less, as well as a friend of ours and a bon vivant around America. So stick with us, and we'll be talking with him in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys at RestaurantGuysRadio.com. Hey there, everybody. Welcome back to The Restaurant Guys. And our guest today is Robert Simonson. Robert Simonson, in the spirit of full disclosure, is a friend. He is also a reporter for the New York Times, where he covers cocktails. What a great job. His blog, which you must follow, it's indispensable if you're a cocktailian like we are. It's called Off the Presses. Robert Simonson, welcome to the show.
Hi, guys. Thanks for having me.
It is great to have you. We've had many conversations over bars and at different cocktail venues across America. It's nice to have you on our radio show.
Absolutely, though I enjoy conversations in bars even better.
You know, is a line I use whenever I teach cocktail classes or wine classes. I say, please, have a drink. I'm funnier when you drink. You know, that's the rule.
So, another line that I just remembered, I don't remember who said it, but something about my drinking keeps you interesting.
that turns the tables. See, self-deprecating is always funnier. You
that
know?
Sounds a little bit like David Wondrich. That'd be my guess. That'd be my guess there.
So I follow you on Twitter, Robert, and we have become friends because we tend to turn up at the same joints a lot, whether it's in New Orleans or in Manhattan or wherever we happen to be in the cocktail world. There was a very insightful tweet the other day. You wrote, overheard, he must be from the New York Times. He's wearing a bow tie.
Yeah, that comment was at Sherry Fest, which was happening this week. There was a grand tasting, and I was there, and I was indeed wearing a bow tie, and I was the only person wearing a bow tie. I think people have this idea still, even in this modern age, they have this idea of what a Times writer looks like, and he always looks kind of tweedy, you know, or
yeah.
Tweed jackets, and you know, maybe patches on the elbows and bow ties and things like that.
Yeah, yeah.
So I had to chuckle at that. The irony was that I only own two bow ties, and I rarely wear them. The one that I was wearing there, I actually bought. I was made to. I was going to a spirited dinner at the Tales of the Cocktail Convention in New Orleans this past July, and the invitation said all men must be attired in a bow tie. And so I dutifully went out, and I bought myself a lovely plaid item. And I went there. You were there, and there weren't that many people wearing bow ties, were there?
Yeah, I ignored that particular directive. One of the reasons is because I look like a big sail with a tiny little bow tie around my neck.
A little bit like McGill Gorilla, to be honest with you.
I think most men feel that way, that they feel they're going to look silly or it's just not going to look right. It's hard to pull off a bow tie. And for many years, I've never gone in that territory because I happen to be a hat lover. I wear hats all the time, and I have for 20 years, and I figure hat and the bow tie, you're really pushing it. But you know, when you're with that cocktail crowd down in New Orleans, you can sort of get away with a hat and a bow tie. You can go as flamboyant and as florid as you want.
You know, I actually own about a dozen or two dozen, let's be honest,
yeah,
bow ties.
You're not getting away with that one with me sitting
and here. I've been wearing bow ties since I was 20. And
Francis is a bow tie pocket square kind of guy.
I guess I am. Let's talk about that that cocktail cruise that we were on. That was celebrating the life and times of Tom Bullock. Go ahead and tell folks who Tom Bullock is.
Well, believe it or not, when I go down to Tales, I actually do try to learn things. And I knew very little about Bullock. So I saw that and I said, okay, well, time to learn. And also, it happens to be on a riverboat. How bad can that be? So everything I know about Tom Bullock, I learned on that boat that evening from David Wondrich, who spoke at the end.
You know, Tom Bullock is the only African-American bartender who has a book that survived, pre-prohibition African-American bartender. And he was pretty famous. And Mark and I put a Tom Bullock section on our cocktail list last year. And, you know, did you get a chance to read the book?
No, I have never seen a copy of the book. Is it good?
It's an interesting book. There's no color. There's very little background or stories on it, on the cocktails. And the recipes are really rudimentary, and you're like, this is, you know, whatever. But if you start messing around with them and use that as a base and sort of realize that you have to get the proportions right and you have to fill in the blanks.
It's like a lot of those old cookbooks where, you know, way back when, if you followed them exactly to the letter, they weren't going to work. But once you start kind of tinkering a little bit, you get there.
We put a whole Tombolic section on the list because the drinks we came up with were phenomenal.
Really great drinks.
And
what's the best bullet drink in your opinion?
He has a drink called a Blackthorn cocktail, which is has slow gin. That's why it's called Blackthorn cocktail. And he has a Horse Thief, two different cocktails that
we really liked.
Pretty interesting. And there's one that we're putting on the new cocktail menu, Cohasset Punch. A Cohasset Punch. And the reason we put the Cohasset Punch on the upcoming menu, which we're launching like tomorrow night, is he calls for an ingredient, which I looked through the book, it blew my mind. He calls for nectarines put up in a spirit. And he uses some of the nectarine and some of the spirit from the preservation liquid. We put up nectarines in Cointreau.
Which is something we've been doing for about 8 years, putting nectarines up in Cointreau every year.
I'm connected spiritually with the ghost of Tom Bullock. So
amazing.
Yeah,
nectarines, it can't be a mistake. There's got to be a connection.
I know. So anyway, so you lead a pretty charmed life. I mean, I think a lot of folks would like to have your job. How did you come to cover cocktails for the New York Times? I mean, lots of cocktail bloggers in the world, not a lot of New York Times reporters covering the cocktail beat.
I came about it in a rather curious, circuitous way. I've been writing for the Times since 2000, but I used to write for the arts and leisure section, and I wrote about theater. I wrote about the arts and theater long before I discovered this whole world of wine and spirits and cocktails. And I've been writing about spirits and cocktails since about 2006, and I started writing for a few other publications like Imbibe and the New York Sun, which is no longer with us. And so after a while, it was sort of somewhat easy for me to go to the folks at Dine-In and say, I've been writing for you guys, but for a different section. And would you give me a chance to write about spirits and cocktails for the Times? You know, and it actually took, you know, 2 years of steady pitching before they actually gave me an assignment. And that was in 2009, and cross fingers, they've been using me ever since then.
What was your first assignment? I'm curious.
My first assignment was extremely appropriate because it was about my favorite cocktail, the Old Fashioned. I wrote a short article about how the Old Fashioned was back in fashion and appearing on menus at some of the new cocktail joints. That's when the mixologists were really rediscovering that cocktail, putting new spins on it, and starting to prepare it in the old 19th century way, as opposed to the mid-20th century way with, you know, the fruit salad, the oranges and the cherries and all that stuff. Yeah. So that was my first piece.
I remember way back when somebody did a seminar at Tales on the Old Fashioned.
It was David. It was Wondrich.
It was David. Yeah, that's who it was. Yeah. Exactly.
And why don't you tell our folks about the Old Fashioned Old Fashioned?
The Old Fashioned, as I understand it, was basically a new name that was given to the whiskey cocktail, which is certainly one of the oldest cocktails in history, and follows the classic template of a cocktail. It's got spirit, it's got sugar, it's got bitters. An Old Fashioned, as they're serving it now, or as I like it, is just a little sugar, a little Angostura bitters, a little water to dissolve the sugar, and then you kind of like muddle that till the sugar is dissolved. You put in a good slug of whiskey, 2 ounces if you want, bourbon or rye, put in a big chunk of ice, and I like to put a pretty good size of orange rind in there. It's very simple and elemental.
When did we get the Old Fashioned?
Well, I believe it started in the late 19th century when new products started to arrive to these shores, things like absinthe and vermouth and various liqueurs. And so the bartenders started messing around with the classic drinks and adding a little bit of this, adding a little bit of that, and I think that eventually led to, like, well, we're not going to just do, you know, lemon zest anymore. We're going to, like, maybe let's try some orange. Let's try some cherry. And if you look at some of the recipes from the late 1800s to the early 1900s, pineapple is actually very common in Old Fashions, just a big chunk of pineapple. pineapple.
But that's newfangled. That's not old-fashioned. That doesn't work.
And so the name came about because purists got sick of this, and they started asking the bartender, I want a whiskey cocktail the old-fashioned way. And it ended up being the old-fashioned.
If reporters go from least desirable to most desirable job, war correspondent, not what I would go into journalism for. Theater reviewer, cocktail guy, that's totally the where my sympathies lie.
I'm with you, although I know there are journalists out there who like nothing better than going to the front, but, you know, I am not that guy.
And you and I shall raise a glass to them in the bar as we write about it.
Exactly.
The cocktail thing, is that a new kind of a beat, or is the Times writing more about cocktails than they have?
They have, and I got to hand it to them. They have really been upping the coverage of spirits and cocktails to bring it about even to what they have always written about wine and, to a lesser extent, beer. There was recently an editorial changeover over in the dining section. They got a new editorial team, and they have been very vocal about how they want more spirits articles, more cocktail coverage, and I'm going to give it to them if they'll let me.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk for a minute then again about the direction of cocktail bars. You know, we lost Lainey Kai at the end of the summer just now, and Brian Miller and Julie Reiner came to the restaurant and did an event with us just after Lainey Kai closed the Tiki event. What's going on with Tiki right now?
Is that dead in New York?
Is that moving forward, or is that going the wrong way?
Yeah, that did seem to be a bit of a death knell. I don't know if that means that, like, Tiki is dead in New York, but it certainly stalled. Losing Lainey Kai was very sad. The Tiki Monday events were probably the best, the epicenter of Tiki culture in New York for the year that they existed. But now that it's gone, Painkiller's still there now, TKNY, but I feel it's sort of lost a bit of its heart when its original partners split about a year after the bar was formed. And then there's the Hurricane Club, but that never really caught on with the cocktail aficionados. But I think it would be rash to say that Tiki's dead because there are other cities than New York, believe it or not. And there are going to be two very great Tiki bars opening in the next year in New Orleans, one of them opened by Jeff Beachbum Berry. And over in San Francisco, Smuggler's Cove is going strong.
You know, I think I want to bring the listeners up to speed that Lainey Kai was a tiki-centric cocktail bar downtown Manhattan, run by our friend Julie Reiner for a year. It was fabulous. It was the beating.
2 years. 2 years. Yeah.
So it was the beating heart of tiki culture in New York City. And you know, Robert, exactly what you said really resonates with sort of my feeling about tiki. To me, in a way, though every bar has a little bit of tiki on it, we have a couple of swizzles on our own menu. You know, tiki doesn't resonate to me with New York. I think that in a place like San Francisco or New Orleans, or you know, a tropical place,
it feels warmer climate. When it's 32 degrees out, I'm not tiki hunting.
Or even in New York, yeah, in the summertime, in the humid 80 degrees as the garbage truck drives by, I'm like, somehow it feels a little forced.
it's hard to create that illusion that you might, you know, be by the beach with the palms swaying. It's true.
Because if you see a guy walking around in a Hawaiian shirt in New York, he's about to get mugged. So that's not cool, right? That's not fun. So I don't know. I can see why it doesn't quite resonate in New York like it might in other places.
And that holds up historically. I mean, among the great tiki towns in history, New York was never one of the big ones. I mean, they had some tiki lounges, some tiki bars, some Polynesian-themed restaurants, but, you know, not like out on the West Coast. Although saying that, I should add that one of the bars that, if I could go back in time and visit a bar, one of the ones I'd love to visit is the Hawaiian Room and the Hotel Lexington. I would love to see that.
I'm unfamiliar.
Yeah, I don't know.
What was that all about?
As far as tiki bars go in New York, Trader Vic's aside, which is in kind of a class by itself, this was probably the best known of the tiki lounges in the 30s, 40s, 50s. It was on Lexington Avenue in Midtown. The Hotel Lexington was a Midtown hotel, and I'm not sure if it was on the first floor or the basement, but there was a very sprawling restaurant/bar called Hawaiian Room, and I actually have a tiki mug from there There are a couple drinks that have survived from there. I think they're in Jeff Perry's books.
I want to ask you a question that Mark and I have debated, and this is really for cocktail geeks. You got to be like into the whole cocktail thing. Ice is very important in drinks. So
you better agree with us.
I like ice in my drinks very often.
A lot of tiki drinks, they call for crushed ice. So in a swizzle, you have crushed ice. And there's a really efficient and wonderful machine. It's a Scotsman ice machine that makes ice pellets, where if you go to a lot of tiki bars, you will have your crushed ice. It's not crushed ice at all. It's these little, very cold, hard pellets that are the size of crushed ice. And swizzles and the likes are made with these Scotsman ice pellets. We don't use one of those. We crush ice for the few swizzles that we do make. And I've found that those, it's my opinion and Mark's opinion, that those Scotsman ice pellets are so good and so cold that they don't really melt in a drink. And so when you drink a swizzle that is made with Scotsman ice pellets, when you're done with the swizzle, you still got 3/4 of a glass full of ice. When you drink a swizzle made with crushed ice, you've got maybe a little bit of crushed ice left on the bottom, you know, or maybe a third. And I'm sorry, but I am a pretty good drinker, and I get loaded I got the sugar high, and I had like two swizzles, and I was out with my girlfriend, and she's like, "What is wrong with you?" And it was like I had
four scotches.
You weren't
drunk. That wasn't the issue.
What was it?
You're just what's wrong with
just
you?
Just a jerk. Yeah. So
you mean when you were having the swizzles with the Scotsman ice?
No.
It was having a bigger effect? That's
yes.
What you mean?
Yes, absolutely. And I also feel that it the drinks are too strong.
There's less melt
when you make them with that ice. Do you have an opinion
on
that?
I would agree with you, because I think one of the functions of ice, and some people out there are certainly going to disagree with me because ice is such a controversial topic, I've found. People have very heated opinions about this subject. For me, one of the purposes of ice is dilution. I know that some people don't like their drinks diluted, but I think it softens the edges of the liquor, and it's important to have that aspect. I encountered the Scotsman ice down in New Orleans. Did you go to that the new bar, Belloc, the one that serves only cobblers?
No, we never made it.
Well, they serve all these cobblers, and so they have to have, like, small ice all the time. They have to have cobbled ice, and so they use the Scotsman. And I didn't make a close study of whether they were melting or not. I guess I was drinking the drinks much too fast. Indeed, they use it down there.
I think that a lot of those recipes are counting on more melt because you're using overproof rum, and it's in fruit juice, so it doesn't taste like anything. Like, there's something self-regulating about drinking a Manhattan. You know, you don't chug it, right? But passion fruit, man, makes the overproof rum go down pretty easy.
Now, tiki drinks are among the most dangerous drinks out there. They are often very sweet. They're brightly colored. They taste like candy, and you don't realize all the alcohol in the rum that you're consuming.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it is dangerous.
And water is an ingredient in these cocktails,
yeah.
And how they change the cocktail over time, for me, is part of the enjoyment of the cocktail, or certain cocktails anyway.
I agree, absolutely.
Hey, listen, stick with us for just a minute. We're going to take a quick break. We're going to come back and talk more with Robert Simonson of the New York Times about cocktails and what we're looking for today and in the future. We're going to ask for some predictions in just a second. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys at restaurantguysradio.com. Economy Paver and Restaurant Supply Company is the oldest dealership in New Jersey. They've been equipping and supplying restaurants since 1932, and they know that to make great food, you need great equipment. You need equipment that doesn't break down, and you can't pay too much for it. Whether you need an emergency replacement or a wholesale kitchen renovation, Economy's knowledge, experience, and integrity are indispensable. Economy Paver and Restaurant Supply is a recognized dealer for all major brands, and they specialize in custom fabrication and ventilation. At Economy, they've got all the tools you need to get the job done, all in one place, all priced right, and delivered to your door. You can visit the Economy Demo Kitchen on Broad Street in Clifton, New Jersey. You can also visit economysupply.com, then call them at 973-279-5500. That's 973-279-5500. Hey there, everybody. Welcome back. It's Mark and Francis. We're here with Robert Simonson of the New York Times. He is the man on the beat for cocktails and spirits for the New York Times. You know, I think it's great that the Times is increasing coverage because it's a more relevant and more important cultural phenomenon. Is that fact or fiction, Robert?
Well, I think it's fact. I mean, drink is as important as food. I mean, there's no denying it. And as far as important openings are concerned, I recently did the fall preview, and there were very many bars to mention, important bars by significant mixologists and bar owners that were coming along, and you have to keep track of these things, and it's become more and more of a job. This is not a small field anymore.
Well, and not only is it's not just like the next new place making the same old drinks. I mean, people are continually reinventing cocktails.
It is evolving. There's no question about it.
What are some of the cool things that you have seen? We'll talk about the places in a moment and give people tips as to where they can go. What are you seeing in the cocktail world that's developing, that's interesting, that's making more interesting and cool and authentic drinks?
Well, as far as drinks, I mean, there are a number of things. One thing I'd like to mention is more in the area of concept.
Mm-hmm.
We've been through the whole speakeasy age, you know, where it was hard to find the bar and you had to have the password and the door was unmarked. And thankfully, I think we're getting out of that rather precious era. And we're getting into an era that I hope will continue, where it's an open, apparent bar, easy to spot, easy to get into, that just happens to make excellent cocktails. And I think this is the direction that the cocktail world has to go. I mean, because if we're all serious, like we say we are, about getting the public to drink better mm-hmm. and become more educated, I mean, why are we hiding it from them?
Yeah.
It's got to be out there. I long for the day in 10 years where you go to your corner bar and they serve an excellent Manhattan and they know what a last word is.
You know, this is
starting to happen at places like Mother's Ruin in Soho. And when the Alchemy team opened Pour and Ribbons this fall, they were clear. You know, mm-hmm. it's not a speakeasy. Anyone can come in. Mm-hmm. We want everyone to know where we are.
We've seen over time each cocktail concept is a little more refined, a little bit more specific. So you have all these different specific little types of cocktail bars. Let's take Tiki as an example. I believe that 10 years from now, 15 years from now, you're going to see a few Tiki drinks on most menus.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to see maybe a little bit less specificity, but you're going to see, you know, your average bar, your corner bar, is going to serve you great cocktails and have a good wine list and have great beers on it. And you're going to see, I believe that you're going to see less specificity. Is that the direction you see us going, or do you think that we're going to continue to
have the cobbler joint in New Orleans?
Exactly.
Well, that's a direction I hope we're going. Speaking of the cobblers, I mean, I loved Belloc in New Orleans, and it made me realize just how versatile the cobbler format is, because they apply it to, I mean, you can go in there and order a cobbler made with any liquor in the back bar, and they will do it, and it will probably taste excellent. But if you have a bar that only makes cobblers, it ghettoizes the cobbler. It makes it a novelty drink. And so I hope in the future, you know, you go in, just like you said, where there will be tiki drinks on every menu, there will be cobblers on every menu. You see cobblers on some menus here in New York and mm-hmm. other places, but I want to see it being more common, and you just completely revive that category of drink from the 19th century and make it so that nobody's surprised. Of course there is a cobbler.
Well, you know, it's funny. I think there's a place for a bar that specializes in one thing or another. Like Emporio Margo downtown specializes in bitters, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And there's, you know, it's a small place. Like there's a place for an Italian restaurant, though. Mm-hmm. You might see pasta on every. You know, you should be able to see pasta on many different kinds of restaurants. There are still restaurants that specialize in pasta.
Or there's a Belgian beer bar, but there are also Belgian beers on most menus.
So that's where I hope it goes.
I'm not saying that, you know, Belloc, you know, shouldn't exist. It's wonderful that it's there. And I like more to Margo, too. I'm just saying in addition.
I couldn't agree more. And we've said for a long time, Mark and I, because I think if we did anything early, Joe Baum was early, but I mean, because of the way things are in New Jersey, where, you know, the little standalone speakeasy is not possible in New Jersey because a liquor license costs $400,000 and $5,000 a year.
Right, and you're not going to 9 different places on the course of
right,
a,
you gotta
a
drive.
Trail. Right.
So, you can't have a little cocktail joint that just serves you, you know, a little bit of food, because you can't make your $400,000 back on 18 seats that are open, you know, 6 hours a day. Because we wanted to do cocktails and we were kind of early on the whole thing, we have a restaurant and we made our bar a great cocktails at a restaurant bar. And we found that we had certain advantages back then before that sort of came into the mainstream, because we had the use of a kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
And now I see that, you know, you don't open a great restaurant in a city, at least, without a great wine list.
Without great cocktails.
You have to have great
cocktails. Part of the formula.
You agree?
No, I do agree, and you see that all throughout New York. You know, when people open a restaurant, they realize they don't just have to have a good wine program. They have to have a good cocktail program, and they're reaching out to, you know, some of the better mixologists. The caution in that is that sometimes they reach out and they get a consultancy, they get consulted, but they don't keep the consultant on. And so the cocktail program will sustain itself for 6 months to a year, but then fall off dramatically. I've seen that happen many times.
Interesting.
Yeah. And the irony, that the things that I've seen in those places is even if they're doing the same drinks, they've lost their acuity in those drinks.
Yeah, yeah.
Because
nobody
cares.
And
it's just like, you know, there seems to be a blind spot with restaurant people where, like, of course, with the kitchen, you keep a sharp eye on it and you make sure your food is at the top level at all times, because if it falls down, then the people stop coming. But they seem to not think the same way about the bar, that you have to constantly watch it and constantly keep your standards up.
How many cocktails does a good cocktail bar have to have on a menu? And how often does that have to change? Because I've seen some great bars with the same 9 cocktails for the last 3 years, and they're great. And you can ask the bartenders to make you other stuff. And I've seen cocktail bars with, you know, many drinks on the menu and a seasonal section that changes. What's your opinion on that?
Kind of twofold. I know the bars you're talking about that keep their menu pretty steady, and if you want to use the negative word, static. But, I mean, if the cocktails are good, I don't have any objection. The flip side of that is if you're constantly changing your menu, the patron doesn't have anything to cling on to. I mean, he finds a drink that he likes, and then the next time he's there, it's gone, and he has to relearn the menu all over again. It gets a bit exhausting after a while. So I think you have to strike the right balance.
That's interesting, and I think that's a little different balance than you strike on your menu. You know, nowadays we want to keep things moving. You don't want much to stay on the menu from time, you know, consistently. And
that depends. I mean, you go to a steakhouse, and I want to see my slab of bacon and my 3-pound 28-day dry aged porterhouse. That's why I go.
Mark's not making that up either, Robert. You should have seen the intensity.
Don't take my cream finish.
You should have seen the intensity in his eyes. It was frightening. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
You can't have a bad cocktail on your menu. I'm not saying it has to be great, but it has. I mean, there's no excuse for a bad cocktail in this day and age.
I agree.
But it has to be something satisfying that you're not going to send back. But I think it's also important that there's got to be 2 or 3 great cocktails.
Yeah.
Hopefully something that they've invented, because we all know certain bars that we associate it with one particular cocktail, which is, you know, above the bar. It's just like you think of PDT and you think of the Benton's Old Fashioned. You know, everyone's had one. Mm. Everyone knows what that tastes like, and that is a modern classic. If you think of Maya, well, you think of the Iwaka Old Fashioned. Pego Club is actually one of the few bars that I know of where there are several drinks on the permanent menu that are modern classics.
Okay, Gin Mules comes to mind for me.
That's
what about
the one
for you?
That, when you started talking about modern classics that identify a place, that was the drink that I thought.
What a drink. What else is in the lexicon?
Gin Mule is the most famous. The Old Cuban, I think, is up there. The Earl Grey Martini, Little Italy. These are drinks. These are all by Audrey Saunders, by the way.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
These are drinks that other mixologists have drafted off for years.
Sure.
Doing spins on spins on spins.
Well, can I tell you something? We did a direct copy of the Gin Mule like a month after Audrey opened, and I did it with permission. She's like, go ahead.
Yeah, we called it the Gin Mule.
By Audrey Saunders. I would like to think, I don't know that there's any, if this is fame or ignominy, but we were the first to copy Audrey Saunders' Gin Mule. We're the first generation copy.
Oh, well, you got good taste.
And by the way, our signature drink is the Parasol. Everyone, when you come to New Brunswick, New Jersey, the Parasol is our drink. I visited a bar that you mentioned just earlier called Pouring Ribbons, which is our friend Joaquin Simo and his esteemed colleagues, the Alchemy Group. They do on their cocktail menu, have you seen their little sliding scale that they have under there? They have a sliding scale. A drink goes from stronger, more spirit-forward to less spirit-forward, and adventurous to original. And they plot all their drinks on it.
Yes, and now that you mention it, yeah, I remember that graph.
And they plot all the drinks on a graph, and under each drink is a little sliding bar for each of those attributes. That's one way to sort of communicate to people as we tend to do new things and bring new things to market. I'm curious as to your opinion about that, and also about there are a bunch of bars that open up now with no menu. And there is no menu, and you have to go to the bartender and says, well, what do you feel like tonight? And I think sometimes I really like that, and sometimes like, oh, for Jesus Christ, just give me a freaking drink menu.
Well, I'm gonna steal this question from you for a second.
Go ahead.
I always want to see a cocktail menu,
right,
even if I want to say, hey, just make me something. Robert, what do you think?
Well, the no menu concept, I guess we can trace it back to Milk and Honey, right?
Yeah.
Opened with no menu. They still have no menu. Actually, when I interviewed Sasha Petrasky, the owner of Milk and Honey, earlier this year, he told me that was because he didn't know how to work a laser printer. He didn't do that on purpose, and then everybody thought he was all pretentious. But now there are other, I guess Drink Up in Boston has no menu. I don't see it that often. I see menus more than no menus.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
Do I like it? Do I dislike it? I don't mind it. I think those bars are probably for the cocktail aficionado who's somewhat advanced, who's gone past beginner and intermediate to advanced. And so they come in knowing the ingredients on the back bar, knowing what they like, and probably have, six to a dozen drinks in their head.
Yeah,
that they want that bartender to make for them that night.
You know what's funny?
But it's not for everybody. You know, if somebody's just getting into this world, yeah, they should have a piece of paper.
Yeah, that's just what I was about to say. You know, I don't mind. Anytime I'm going out for cocktails, for me, I want it to be a learning experience. So that's fine for me. That's fine for Francis. But maybe I'm bringing somebody along who isn't as adventurous as I am, or isn't as
knowledgeable. They don't know what to do.
And I think it's tough on them.
If you look at it a certain way, the no menu thing is a bit of a pose. It makes the bar more about the mixologist than the patron.
Mm-hmm.
It's about, like, what I have in my brain and what I can do with my hands, not necessarily about, putting you at ease.
I think it's funny because whenever I do that just to piss them off, I order a Pousse Café with 9 layers.
I have never had a Pousse Café.
They're disgusting.
There are some that are decent.
They sound disgusting, but I'm fascinated by them a little bit.
There was I forget which Pousse Café was ordered, but there's one of our bartenders, a great bartender who also is a mixologist, which is what we can have great bartenders who aren't mixologists, but if you're a great mixologist and not a bartender, who needs you?
Then I don't want to sit.
Who needs you?
Then I don't want to sit in front of
you. A great bartender and mixologist who works for us, a guy named Chris Stanley. He tells a story about, he said the only time he ever actually made a Pousse Café that wasn't just him messing around was for a customer that ordered one. Pousse Café, for you guys who are listening, is a layered drink, and it can be 3, 7, 9 layers.
And usually it's many different colors,
and it's
all
beautiful.
About the specific gravity of each
right.
of the each of the liquors. So,
you need to know what to put on top of
so
what.
They're
going to
be layered, and they're going to be different colors in each layer.
And if you're talking about pain in the ass, it is the number one pain in the ass drink that thankfully no one drinks.
And color is more important to this drink than flavor.
Yeah. Well, so
yeah, it's definitely the optical.
So Chris makes.
I remember a couple of years ago when they came back with Creme Vets,
Violet
liqueur,
sure.
And everybody was all excited, says we've got Creme Vet back, and then everyone kind of stopped, like, okay, besides the aviation, what do we do with this stuff? And the makers of Creme Vet were saying, finally, you can make the perfect, correct Pousse Café, and I was thinking, nobody wants to do that.
We brought you purple.
Baked Alaska. Who needs it? I will give one shout out to one drink that uses that Creme Vette. Was made by Agostino Peroni, who is at the cocktail bar at the Connaught Hotel. He makes a drink called a Florissimo.
And oh yeah, great drink with Creme Vette.
And what that is that's basically like a champagne cocktail. It's a sugar cube, a bittered sugar cube, and he throws in a little bit of brandy and a little Creme Vette, and then he pours champagne on top of that and garnishes it with fresh rose petals.
And it is so delightful.
Oh my goodness, it's delicious.
That sounds lovely.
And you know when
and
he breaks
for the record, yeah. And for the record, Creme Vette is a lovely product.
Yeah, the
it
Creme
is
Vette
not just
know.
Purple.
Yeah, no, it's good stuff. But what I was with the Pousse Café story that I wanted to finish is that. When Chris finally makes this guy a Pousse Café, it said it took him like 15 minutes, and he had to like look in a book to remember where what went above what, and he presents it to the guy. The guy stirred it before he drank it. He said, Francis, I had to take a break. I told the other bartender, you watch the bar for a few minutes. I'm going away. Oh, my. Hey, Robert, I'm afraid we're out of time, but it was really a pleasure talking with you on the radio. You're fantastic.
Oh, well, thank you very much. I had a great time.
You can follow Robert Simonson by subscribing to the New York Times and reading about cocktails there, or his blog is Off the Presses. You can also find out about him by going to restaurantguysradio.com under this show, and we will link you to him. So stick with us. We'll be back with you in just a moment. We are the Restaurant Guys. Hey there, everybody. Welcome back. It's Mark and Francis. I was doing a little walk down memory lane with Robert Simonson because I was thinking, you know what my first layered drink was, and maybe yours too?
I don't know.
Come on, you know.
A mind eraser.
It was a layered drink that you drank in reverse through the bottom with a straw.
It was vodka, then
Kahlua,
then club soda.
Yeah, on the top.
On the top.
It was vodka on the bottom, then Kahlua, then club soda. So it went strong, sweet,
and then
clean up your palate because it's disgusting.
And they were called mind erasers. And I'm sure the story that Francis is thinking about was I had some people in my bar one night who started with mind erasers.
stayed for about four or five hours,
had a bunch of cocktails, had some food. Then I gave them their check. They're like, what are these drinks here? Those are mind erasers. We didn't have any of those. See, they worked.
Oh, alcohol's a drug. Be very careful out there. Alcohol is indeed a drug.
Mind eraser. Welcome to the 80s.
Yeah. My ignominious drinks of the past were the mind eraser, the fuzzy wuzzy woo woo, which I'm ashamed that I did have a drink of. Used to drink those occasionally.
Did you really?
Once or twice we did them in the early days of bartending, 87.
Yeah.
Come on, I was wearing a leather tie, for God's sake.
A skinny leather tie
and drinking a fuzzy wuzzy woo woo. Oh my God, thank God I recovered. And of course, my first drink when I had, and I've said this before on the show, also ignominious, was the, and I'll preface this by saying that Jim Meehan asked me to write for the latest Food and Wine Magazine annual cocktail book. They gave, 50 bartenders from across the country, or 100, however many bartenders they wanted drinks. They gave them a classic recipe and they said, give us your classic. Then give us a conservative twist on it and give us a real modern contemporary twist on it. So I got, thank you, Jim Meehan, I got the mudslide, right? No, was it a mudslide? No, the white Russian.
White Russian.
I got the white Russian. And so I did the standard white Russian, and I did a white Russian with horchata syrup that I worked with Chris Stanley, our bartender, on. It's actually quite good. But the white Russian, terrible drink to be drinking as a cocktail. It's creamy. It's ice cream. It's an ice cream cone.
I would like one of those in my life.
And I remember that I had snuck into a club at the top of the Eagle Rock Reservation called Creations to see a Chaka Khan concert. I was 18. The drinking age was 19. Mm-hmm. And the bartender said, what do you have? And I was like, white Russian? Because the only other choice in my head was whiskey sour. And that might have been worse. I made the wrong choice, is what I thought. But, despite the dramatic memories, I've redeemed myself if you pick up this year's Food and Wine Cocktail Book. Hey, I'm afraid we're out of time. I hope that you enjoyed this hour as much as we have. My name is Francis Schock.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are the Restaurant Guys. You can hear us at restaurantguysradio.com.